with us. Come play with us, Daddy. Forever and ever and ever.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Whatever you do, don't fall.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of a Year in Horror podcast. Today, we are joined by Ben Ward. He is the singer from the UK metal band Orange Goblin. Now, the film that he chose to discuss is my very favourite film of all time. It's The Biggie in Horror, the Stanley Kubrick adaptation of Stephen King's novel. Yes, indeed it is. It's The Shining. Of course it is. But before we get there, just a little bit of housekeeping. This podcast has a Patreon channel where I put up extra content and I do it at least 3 times a month. Currently, I'm tackling the top tier 39 video nasties. They're all going on over there. Plus, there's a lot of other content as well. Music content. There is more individual movie content. There is extra chats from the main channel. Loads going on. Have a look, and if you'd like to support the show in any way, you can sign up on that patreon.com/ayearinhorror. There's a £3 tier, there is a £4 tier. It's a good time with or without beer. But if you're a bit short and you want to support the show in some other way, and if you listen to this via Apple, why not rate the show and leave a review? That'd also be ace. Finally, if you just want to have a chat, if you want to send me some information, if you want to instigate a war, email me at ayearinhorror@gmail.com. I think I'm going to be deleting the Year in Horror Facebook page pretty soon. I so hate Facebook, so probably best that you don't contact me there, but I'm available all over anyway at Waller, not Weller. Right, that's all that out of the way. The Shining. It was a VHS tape that I watched repeatedly as a kid. I had the small box Warner retail version. Probably bought it from W.H. Smith's in Margate. So I had many, many, many rewatches of that thing. There's not a lot left to be said about The Shining that hasn't already been said, to be honest. There are countless thought pieces out there. There's documentaries. There's extras on various editions of the movie that you can buy. There is books. So yeah, there's not a lot else that I can add to the table here, but I would say that with Kubrick, well, some of that camera direction here is exquisite. Something I noticed for the first time on my most recent rewatch for this, and I've got to say, I just loved it, was the way that the camera follows the axe on those first two swings at the bathroom door. Never noticed that before. It's those little touches that make this so, so exquisite. And the casting, again, it's perfect. Of course, everybody talks about Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance. He's a nutbag from the off. Shelley Duvall as Wendy Torrance. Pitch perfect. Danny Lloyd, though, as little Danny, Daniel Torrance. Again, I think it's a killer performance. Another thing that I've got to mention is that it's still got the power to freak me out. It made me jump out of my skin yet again. How many times have I watched this? Too many to mention. When it flashes up the day title card, I think it was Monday, after Danny and Wendy make it into the middle of the maze, I literally leapt up from the sofa, stood on 2 feet, jumped out my freaking skin. As I say, there's not a lot else to bring to the table here, but I will think of something, some way to do it when we hit the 1980 Big Hitter episode. But for now, this is Ben Ward's show, Orange Goblin's show. And as I mentioned, Ben, he chose The Shining to chat about today. So all I can say about that is, like, hell yes. I can't believe that nobody else has chosen this one yet. And for those not in the know, And if you want to find a little bit more out about Ben, well, type Orange Goblin into your favourite streaming service and just hit shuffle. You're going to have a mad good time of it. And then whilst that's going on, just hop over to Wikipedia and do the same thing. Put Orange Goblin in there and have a read. I found out from my most recent little Wikipedia fact find that the band formed in 1995. Plus, I thought I owned a lot of their back catalogue. 5 albums I've got of theirs, but nope, nowhere near. They've got 2 live albums, a stack of EPs, and 9 full-length albums of original material. 9! Okay, here we go. This one, by the way, I just want to say this is great. I've met Ben a few times in real life, but we've never chatted for more than a few minutes, and it has always been about music. It was ace to chat with him about horror. I think he felt the same. It's just nice to talk about something that isn't music for a change. So yeah, this is Ben Ward and myself going in on the current status of Orange Goblin and, of course, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you very much, Paul. Pleasure to be on.
Dude, right. Okay, so before we go into this, I've got to speak to you a little bit about Orange Goblin. So the first thing I need to know, what's currently going on with Orange Goblin? Like, there hasn't been a new release, like a proper new one, since The Wolf Bites Back. So what's going on with new material, first of all? And then when are you playing it?
Well, new material is on its way. We announced a new record deal last year with Peaceville Records, which is, you know, a bit of a dream come true for us, because we all grew up listening to, you know, the doom bands that kind of have shaped us as a band, that were always, you know, put out by Peaceville, the likes of My Dying Bride and Anathema and early Paradise Lost, all that stuff. So, you know, as well as the likes of Autopsy and Dark Throne, who obviously aren't so much of a sort of relative influence, But, you know, it's always been a label we admire. So to do a deal with them was great. And so far, so good. They've been very supportive. They're very patient, which obviously you need to be working with Orange Goblin. But as you say, you know, last record, Wolf Bites Back, was 2018. But since we finished the UK tour last December, we have been in the studio and we're frantically working on new material. And it's the same old thing. It's putting together riffs that we've had lying around for a long time, mixing them up with new stuff, new ideas. And obviously there's a new element to the band now with Harry on bass instead of Martin. So you know, we're close to having 4 or 5 new songs done, and we're open to record and have that done by the end of the year for a possible early release in 23. With regards to live, we're a week out from the first show of the year, which is obviously Desert Fest in London, which we're excited about, because originally that was supposed to take place in 2020, and obviously COVID put a spanner in the works. But you know, it was going to be a celebration of our 25-year anniversary. I don't think it's really, you know, the dumb thing to celebrate 27 years. there's no kind of associated colour or metal to celebrate that, like you do with weddings and things. So, we're just glad to be back. We're glad Desert Fest is happening. We're glad to see festivals happening again and tours taking place. As you know, you're a musician yourself, so it's been a really frustrating couple of years for everybody in the music industry. Right. Take a back seat and you know, especially bands that were on album cycles and things like that, to all of a sudden have touring taken away was a big loss. So we're really excited about Desert Fest next week. And then a week after that, we head to the States. We're doing 4 shows over there, one of them being Desert Fest New York. We haven't been to the States since 2019, so that's going to be nice to get over there. It's kind of spread out. We fly to Seattle, do 1 show there, then fly all the way back to the East Coast to do New York, Boston, Philadelphia. So strange routing, but There you go. And then after that, we've got a festival, Summer of Festivals, Desert Fest Berlin. It sounds like we just do Desert Fest, doesn't it? But no, we're off to Sweden Rock. We're doing Into the Grave in the Netherlands. We're doing Rockfest Barcelona. We're doing Hellfest. We've got a few things up and down the UK as well, festivals like Steelhouse, doing Rock in the Bowl, this thing called Trainwreck Festival in Bradford. There's plenty to keep us busy, but, you know, obviously, as you say, I run my own business as a booking agent as well. So I need to, you know, fit it all together somehow. And it's not easy sometimes, especially, you know, since I relocated to Watford in February, it's been manic, really manic, just trying to sort of get the company straightened out and up and running, organizing contracts and invoices, work permits, all that sort of stuff. Yes. Navigating Brexit and COVID and everything else in between. It's just nonstop. So, but, you know, I'm in a good place. I still manage to find time to watch horror films, so that's good.
Yeah, too right. And like, I remember when those posters were coming through for your American tours, and I and the rest of my band could not believe the amount of dates that you guys were putting yourselves through. Yeah. Did that kill you? Did it literally kill you? Because I can't imagine touring that long, let alone in another country.
It's a miracle that we're all still alive. Because A, sort of the abuse on the roads should have killed one of us, or we should have killed each other. So, you know, but no, I mean, that's going back to around the time 2013 when Eulogy for the Damned came out and we started doing the band full time. We all gave up our day jobs, gave it a crack. It didn't work out financially because, unfortunately, you know, this style of music, it's never going to be on top of the pops. So, you know, we had a good crack at it, and we were doing something like 170 shows a year, and that involved going to the States for kind of, you know, like 3 months of the year, and with families and mortgages and rent to pay and things like that, it's not viable. So we went back to doing what we know and working at home and just doing the band when we can, and it's always seemed like a hobby. That's why it's so much fun, because it's like get the opportunity to get together with your mates, create the music you want to hear, and go out and have a good time, and, you know, as you well know. So yeah, it's you know, it's an honor to still be able to do it after 27 years. It really is. You know, I never thought that would be the case when we first started. We had the intention of maybe doing a couple of demos and playing a few shows here and there, but it just kept snowballing, and here we are.
I noticed going through your back catalogue just today, there's a few titles in there that are horror related, and there's no getting around it. Like every now and again, one pops up. I've written a few down, and these are the ones that I've considered in the past were horror. Tell me if I'm wrong, please. Okay. Yeah. So here we go. Crown of Locusts. Is that a horror track?
It weren't, essentially. That was when, after we toured with Grand Magus, it was kind of a more of a Viking thing. So, but I can probably see where you're coming from, because, you know, the whole, I don't know, it's kind of had a kind of Candyman sort of feel to it with the bee, something along those lines. But no, that weren't originally one of them that was written with a horror theme.
I've got more. Okay, next.
Although I probably need to revisit the lyrics, because there's a good chance you might be right.
That's it, yeah. A lot of these are a bit more recent, but I'm still going to go through them. I'm still going to go through them, because I'm going to need to know. So They Come Back, Harvest of Skulls.
Yeah, that was obviously written. Obviously, there's Sometimes They Come Back, the horror film.
Right.
But and then taking the They Come Back, it was because we wrote that album based on the theme of the fire and the plague around 1600s in London, and I just thought it'd be good to put a spin on that whole thing with the plague pits and all the dead coming back to life, and London being sort of engulfed with zombies and things. So yeah, that definitely had a horror feel to it.
Phew, okay, next one I think I'm in with the next two. So we got The Fog.
Yeah,
right, come on.
Obviously that was an ode to the John Carpenter classic.
Yep, Escape from New York, right? Yeah. And then we've got Bloodzilla, come on. Oh no,
possibly, yeah. I just like the sound of the words. Like combining blood and Godzilla, so yeah, it's just sort of you know, probably. I mean, one glaring one that you missed is the song Lazy Mary, which was named after the truck in Evil Dead. The number plate on that is Lazy Mary.
Oh mate, yes. Ah,
that's one that not many people, and obviously Red Tide Rising, a lot of the stuff has connotations with Lovecraft and you know, gothic horror literature. There's quite a bit of that in there.
Is it you that puts these ideas forward in the band, or is there someone else that goes, oh.
I'm solely responsible for the lyrics. And you know, when we started off, we was all very sort of Rainbow and Sabbath and that sort of thing. And then we went through a phase of sort of, you know, motorcycles and stuff like that. And then I've realized, you know, what my passions are. My passions are horror, and whether that's sort of, you know, in film horror or literature horror, then, you know, so just sort of combining ideas and having a bit of fun with it.
Right. Okay. We'll get to it. Let's get to horror. Okay. Yeah. So my favorite film of all time, for many a year, has just been The Shining. You chose The Shining. Do you feel the same with this one? Do you think it can't be topped?
I do. I mean, it's one that's always been there. And it's only recently that I've realized that it is my favorite horror film of all time. You know, as a kid, you try to be a little bit kind of outrageous with your taste, and you would start naming all these obscure movies that when you first watched them as a kid, you thought, oh, that's amazing. But then you look back and you realize, actually, it's not that great. It's just, I liked it at the time because it was shocking. It was offensive to people. But, you know, The Shining has stood the test of time, and just everything about it, sort of the way it resonates with me, it suggests to me that it's the perfect film.
Yeah. One of the questions later on is like the worst moments in it. And I struggled to find anything. The issue I had this time around was I have an old DVD of it, popped it on, and it was in a 4:3 ratio. So I thought, that can't be right. That can't be good. And of course, that's how it was meant to be. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And then I bought that 4K UHD and I saw so many things that I'd never seen before.
Yeah.
When you rewatched it for this, or when your most recent watch was, did you notice anything different when you're looking at it with like a more of, I know I've got to chat about this now, that eye?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of that was brought to light by the documentary, the Room 237 documentary, that came up with all these sort of flaws to it, like the layout of the hotel and everything, and the window in the office of the manager. And things like that, and saying, you know, they couldn't fit that ballroom inside the Overlook and things like that. And it was all, you know, but that's all part of it. That's what Kubrick does in his movies. And that's what's great about The Shining, is that it's kind of an amalgamation of all these sort of scenarios that probably shouldn't work together, but do. And it encapsulates everybody's worst nightmares and everything. Because essentially, you know, it's a ghost movie. It's about a haunted house, really. This, you know, goes back to all those House on Haunted Hill and all those sort of things. But can you spend a night in this place? And, you know, in this place, it's Jack and his family spending the summer months looking after the hotel, winter months, sorry, looking after the hotel, and can they handle it? But, you know, it's just so well crafted. As with everything Kubrick does, it's meticulous in its details. There's little things here and there that you notice, and that's what spawned all these conspiracy theories about it and everything. And I don't know how much truth there is in whether it was about, you know, the annihilation of the Native Americans, or whether it's got, you know, links to the Holocaust and all this sort of stuff that you read and you hear about. But what I do know is it's a bloody amazing movie. Like, the cinematography is incredible, the soundtrack's incredible, the storyline, and just the encapsulating kind of claustrophobia that it creates, and the you know, everybody can relate to, because everybody experiences that when you spend any time on your own, especially recently with sort of lockdown and everything. You know, isolation does cause, you know, you to go insane. It causes that kind of fractious relationships between you know, families and people you're close to. So it is the nail on the head in so many aspects.
I think what you said about Kubrick is so right. Like, he is such, he uses such finesse with everything he did. I recently went to that Kubrick exhibition was in London.
At Somerset House.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I went to that as well.
Oh, mate, what I saw in there was amazing. Like, I was looking at, like, he didn't even do the film Napoleon, but he wanted to do it. And just the filing cabinets full of ideas and dates and, like, just every single thing that he could think of, and he's going to pull a story together from these filing cabinets. And I just think, my word, like to be in that set in front of that guy, like working on one of those films, must have been amazing.
That's what I love about him, that he's, you know, he's his own man. He doesn't sort of listen to anybody. He wouldn't take sort of orders from any studios, from any sort of financial advisors or anything. It was all his work, and he was doing it his way. You know, that's why there was the controversy that Stephen King weren't happy with the movie and they didn't get on or see eye to eye over it. He's like, it was his take on it. The whole script writing thing, he went about that himself. And you know, I love that. And that's the controversy around Kubrick is, you know, I think that's great about him. You know, even up to Eyes Wide Shut, it was kind of, you know, what he was conveying was what goes on in Hollywood, you know, that them private parties and the debauchery and everything that happens. And that's why they tried to silence him and so many things that he was about to expose. So, you know, and you see that in everything he's done from 2001, Clockwork Orange, Dr. Strangelove, everything. But, you know, The Shining was probably his sole attempt at horror, and he done it in such a miraculous way that, you know, you can't just consider The Shining as simply a horror movie. It's a thriller, it's psychological, it's got a bit of everything, it's got comedy in there, it's got everything you need. It's brilliant.
I was raised with a drunk as the head of my household. So my dad was a real sort of violent drunk guy. So I can see within this, and it's only as an adult, watching this as a kid, I would just watch this as my horror film and I would be like watching Jack Nicholson and I'd just be loving his every move and things like that. Watching it as an adult and looking at Shelley Duvall, and the way she's portraying Wendy. And I know that Kubrick like put her through the ringer. But this performance, it was making me well up, like just seeing all these things that I recognised from my childhood. I don't think I've seen a performance like that intense from that woman. And I don't get why I didn't notice it as a kid, like watching this film again and again.
Yeah, I mean, I've read interviews where she said that the filming process made her physically ill because of the demands that Kubrick was putting on her on a daily basis. And you know, when she's sort of waving the bat around on the stairs in that movie, you can see that she's physically drained, and it's genuine, and I mean she's never topped that performance in anything, and I don't think Jack Nicholson has either, as great as he is, but Shelley Duvall's performance is incredible, and as you say, anyone that's ever sort of grown up around, you know, an abusive drunk or something, that comes across in the storyline from really early on, when she mentions about Jack dislocating Danny's arm and things like that in a drunken rage, and that sort of inspired him to stop drinking. So it taps on so many sort of social situations as well.
That's what I love about it, is he never goes for the tear jerk. He doesn't do a Spielberg at any point. He just like, this is a matter of fact of what's happening here.
Well, he stitched Spielberg up with the filming of The Shining, didn't he? Because they was recording filming at Elstree, and I think they overrun by something like 9 months, and Spielberg was supposed to be in there doing Raiders of the Lost Ark at the time, so he had to write up about it. Like you were saying about the attention to detail, Cooper, with the filing cabinet and everything, there's little things like the all work and no play pages that are on the desk that apparently he typed them up himself. And there was no way that he could do it, you know, using a machine or something, because of different layout and different patterns and mistakes here and there. It's just incredible attention to detail. Because none of the sort of prop department said that he asked them to do it. So he must have done it himself.
Yeah, but that's the thing. And it's the thing with being an artist, like whether it's a musician, whether it's a filmmaker, whether it's an actor, like, if you are truly into your craft, you will take that extra bit of time, which no one may notice until years later, but you know it's there, you know, you've affected that into your mind. And I imagine when he watched this, he was like, oh, I wish I'd maybe done that, and things like we would.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, his attention to detail was everything. And that's why it took so long to make his films. And his body of work probably isn't as extensive as the likes of Hitchcock and people like that, because he stewed over stuff for so long and made sure he got every little detail right.
Okay, I've mentioned Jack Nicholson, his performance in this, And the only thing that I'm going to take, we'll go into favourites in a sec, but I just want to go into dislikes. The only thing I could sort of possibly pull from it is that I'm scared of Jack Nicholson from the moment I see him on screen. And I think it's his face, his actual face, his fault. He can't help that. It's just what he looks like.
It's demonic, isn't it?
But that's the only thing. Like, there isn't this, like, ramping until it's actually I'm going loopy. So I'm already scared of him from the off. Is there anything that you could find as, like, I wish this was done differently or anything like that?
Well, I kind of agree with that. And I've read interviews with Stephen King about that, who he didn't want Jack Nicholson cast, because obviously Jack Nicholson was obviously famous for his role as a psycho in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest anyway. And Stephen King said the whole story is based on this gradual descent into madness. But when people see Jack Nicholson, they instantly associate him with being mad already. So they're not going to get this feeling of slowly going insane. Whereas I think he wanted John Voight to play the role originally. But but yeah, I understand what you mean. I can't think off the top of my head of anything that I would do differently. I don't know. It's but I'm glad you brought that up about the Jack Nicholson thing, because, you know,
it's the only thing that I can find. And do you know what? I don't care. I fucking love it from that scene when he's in the car. I just love it. I just love his face. Like, just knowing what's coming, I'm like rubbing my hands, going, yes, I'm watching this again.
Yeah, I mean, even then, in that scene in the car when they're talking, and Danny mentions about cannibalism, he saw a program about it on TV, and Jack Nicholson's like, yeah, he saw it on TV. He's kind of already suggesting that he's, you know, not quite all there.
I know if my dad had said something like that, I would have just been like, oh, I'm going to get hit later. Bloody fuck. You know, I'm already scared of this guy.
Hey, I shouldn't laugh at that, really.
No, well, you know, okay. Fair enough. The other thing that I watch and I think about it, but it doesn't stop the enjoyment I get, is that knowing what Shirley Duvall went through, I can watch films like The Exorcist, where when the actor was yanked back, when she was yanked back, and like it sort of damaged her back and her spine, and the way these people are being treated. But I always wonder whether you would have got that end result, and then whether it's worth getting that end result for causing that person pain. And I'm always on the edge. And this is where I go with it. Like, I love Metallica, but I am a vegan, and knowing what James does when he's like shooting bears or whatever. And this is weird juxtaposition in my head where I love this body of work, but I can't abide with what he does as an individual. Yeah. Does it ever run through your head when watching films? Not just necessarily this, but can it put you off something?
I guess so. It depends on the context. I mean, I understand that good actors and actresses throw themselves into things, you know, 100%, and that's what yields the best results, as you say. I think when there's sort of violence for violence sake, and it's just gratuitous, it's an unnecessary, it's kind of, that's more disturbing than anything. I think it's just the fact that, you know, they've been corralled into doing that. So those sort of things, you know, you can take something like a Serbian film, for example, which is, you know, it's gratuitous for the sake of it, but it needed to be to highlight that. And, you know, The Shining never does that. And that's what's so good. Again, going back to the performances of, like, Shelley Duvall, a lot of it was ad-libbed at the time, you know, like the Here's Johnny thing when the axe goes through the door. No one was expecting him to do that. And he'd taken that from watching, was it the Johnny Carson show or something? And Kubrick loved it, so left it in. And it was spontaneous, but it was, and that's what makes it creepy, because, you know, you can tell that it's just genuine and off the cuff.
I can't imagine, like, having the nerve, having the balls to go into his film and start ad-libbing lines and then having them kept in.
Yeah.
What the fuck? How did you do that? Well, I wanted to leave on a positive note. So that's why I didn't want to go straight into that. What do you dislike about it? So please tell me what as saying, right, this is the last time I'm going to watch this film. What is the favourite moment? What are you going to take from it as, like, oh, that's such a great bit?
I just think the first thing I remember being really creeped out about was one of the first times I ever watched it, and just that end scene with the photograph on the wall and him being the caretaker in that photograph, right, and being from back in 1921, and just thinking, oh, that, I mean, even now it gives me goosebumps and chills because you don't expect that sort of thing. It's like, you know, then you start looking back through the film when he's talking to Greg, he's like, you've always been him, and stuff like that. And it's just like, ah, now it makes even more sense, and without making sense. So, you know, it's, I think that's really spine chilling. There's so many, I mean, as a kid, it kind of focused on everything that I was kind of scared of. You know, I grew up from a generation that I started watching, you know, The Exorcist and The Shining and Michael Jackson's Thriller, John Landis, and, you know, the original Nightmare on Elm Street and things like that. So, you know, the scenes, the twins, things like that, the blood gushing out of the elevator, and just little scenes like that you know, even the rabbit sitting on the end of the bed, the guy dressed as a rabbit sitting on the end of the bed, things like that terrified me as a kid, and really sort of stayed with me. So, you know, there's so many amazing moments, and Jack Nicholson's performance, just there's that still where he's just sort of staring into space, and it just the camera pans back, and it's just incredible sort of tension in the air, and the atmosphere captured on film is brilliant. There's no two ways about it. It's the best film ever made.
Yeah, well, there's a rub. Like it's impossible to pin down that one thing that you love about it, because you'll get something different every time. The most recent watch for me a couple of days ago was the part where you finally know you can't just tread around him now. When he says, "Don't disturb me when I'm writing," and he uses like an F-bomb just in the middle of the speech, and then it clicks, and you're scared for her. Yeah.
And you see her face, the look on her face kind of says it all, how shocked she is by it, and the way she grabs Danny and gets him away from him. And
it's incredible.
It's horrific in everything it does. It's, like I say, and that's because it's you know, it delves into your worst nightmares, but it also delves into situations that you can relate to in real life.
So was this film, I think we've covered The Shining. I mean, everyone knows The Shining. It's like one of the most popular horror films there's been. But growing up, was it, you mentioned that this is like your favourite now, but not particularly then. Like, what were you into as a kid, like growing up with like your VHS store? Where did you go? What did you go for?
Like I say, I grew up, I mean, I was born in 1974. My first memories of horror was seeing my mum collected Stephen King books. And getting into them. Funnily enough, I'd never read the book The Shining, because I was so enamored by the movie the first time I watched it. I don't think I've ever bothered to go back and read the book. Right. So my mum was always into horror movies, and I remember seeing, you know, at that time around sort of late 70s, early 80s, there was always a lot of stuff like even Tales of the Unexpected on TV, stuff like that. And then you had obviously Hammer House of Horror and all the Amicus anthologies on Vault of Horror and Tales from the Crypt and stuff like that, that I loved, because they were typically British as well. They had that British sort of essence to it, which is why I still love Amicus and Hammer and everything related to that sort of thing. And but then, you know, as I say, early 80s, you had the boom of sort of video nasties, which I was getting to an age then, and especially mid 80s when you was at school with your mates and sneaking off to watch an Evil Dead or Count of Ferox or something. So you start getting into that. And then you get to an age where I sort of thought I was a little bit more sophisticated and more of a connoisseur, and got into Giallo and started watching Argento and Fulci and stuff like that. And you sort of take all that on board. And then you start to realize that there's also like the Spanish stuff, like the, what's his name? I can't think of his name, the Spanish dude that did all that. But then,
Franco.
There's Jess Franco, who did like the werewolf and stuff like that. Yeah, as I say, you go through that Euro horror phase where you're digging all that.
I'm there right now. That's where I am.
And then you sort of come back to it, I don't know whether it's a nostalgia thing or what, but you go back to, you know, I loved American Werewolf in London. That was one of the first films that really drew me into horror genre as well, because again, it tapped into what nightmares I had as a kid, like the forest scene in that, and seeing Jack coming back, slowly decaying throughout the movie and things. And it was just, an ingrained passion in me as from a kid. I've always loved that thrill of being scared and everything. And, you know, I never used to want to go to bed with the lights off because, you know, my mum would listen to War of the Worlds downstairs. And even that would terrify me as a kid, that Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds. So, you know, I've always had that. I've always got a buzz off being scared. So
that's great.
And yeah, I mean, that's what's led me back to where I am now. And I was one of these people that was very kind of dismissive of remakes, especially, you know, modern era remakes of things. But I've now grown to accept them and seen them for what they are. And sometimes, you know, you can appreciate now as you get older that some of these directors are doing a bloody good job of these remakes. With, you know, some things I don't agree with, but you know, there's some exceptions to the rule.
Has there been a recent film in horror that you've actually really bonded with and you've really enjoyed?
And I loved like Killing of a Sacred Deer, and there was something in the Ghostland that I saw recently as well, which was pretty good. I can't think of what the actual title is. I don't pay as much attention now. I'm not kind of so quite as obsessive as I used to be. But yeah, there have been good films over the past few years, especially coming out of places like Australia as well. There's been a few Australian movies which I've been impressed by, and obviously still there's a lot of French stuff as well that I'm pretty impressed with. Stuff like Martyrs, and obviously, you know, not quite so recent now, but yeah, I mean, it's a genre that continues to surprise me, because just when you think everything's been done, something new comes along and taps into the part of your brain that you didn't know was there.
Right. It is so varied. Like, that's the thing. There's so much that you can take from it. If you want to watch a slasher, you can watch an old one, or there'll be something around the corner, like, you know, coming out in a few months that you can watch. Or if you want to watch an art house film, you know, A24 or whoever's just doing like big guns at the moment. Yeah. I am totally obsessed. In the last year, I've watched things like Martyrs for the first time and all these other films that I'd missed. And it's a whole new world for me. It's so amazing. I love
A24 is doing some great stuff. And, you know, I've enjoyed watching some of the Conjuring movies. I really enjoyed Hereditary. I thought that was a great film and had some really, it was a bit of a slow burner. And that's what I think today causes a lot of the criticism of modern horror films, is because everybody wants instant gratification. And the good thing about horror is you need that tension to build up for the explosive ending, and that's all part of what horror should be, that sort of underlying current of dread and fear and unexpected, not knowing what's coming. So, you know, people just say, oh, it's a bit slow. I like that about films. I've no problem with that.
No, that's the thing, especially when you start to take in Europe for your films. Like, if you're not into that sort of slow burn stuff, you're going to miss out a huge amount of amazing films. Yeah. So it's a silly way to think. I'm glad we've had this chat. But going forward, you've mentioned all these different horror things. New album. What's the ratio of horror songs to biking songs?
Actually, the stuff I've got in my head is leaning a lot more towards horror than biker That's stuff. It. And I'm funnily enough, it's kind of, I'm looking at mixing sort of the Lovecraftian horror with more sort of Philip K. Dick sort of science fiction and that sort of thing, to make it even weirder.
I can't wait. Do you have like a rough estimate of when this will be coming out? Well, I know you can't give us a date, but like an estimate of when.
As I say, I'm hoping we're going to record before the end of the year and looking to release possibly early 23. I think that's realistic.
Sweet. Ben, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Paul. It's been an absolute honour. Thanks for having me.
there you have it. So much thanks go out to Ben Ward from Orange Goblin there for taking part on the show. And yeah, there will be a new big hitter episode coming on the first of the month. But until then, thank you for listening. Be horrible.
Excellent.
You know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Ever you do, don't fall.